Welcome to the Film Experience Podcast. It's your host, Nathaniel, back with your other host, Murtada.
Hi, everyone.
And today we have two movies that you probably haven't seen and don't want to see. It would be pleasurable for you to listen to, surely. We know how to pick our subjects.
Yes. I mean, everything in theaters except Avengers seems to have flopped. People are seeing nothing.
Yeah.
Or at least very few people are seeing anything other than Avengers.
Yes. And since Murtada refused to see that, we never ended up discussing it. So you only see one superhero picture a year, so what are you saving yourself for?
I don't know, until I see something that, you know, pikes my interest. We'll see. Maybe this will be the year I see none.
Well, that would be very counterculture of you.
Yes.
So we did go see a movie together yesterday.
Yeah, Palms,
which was a movie.
Yes.
What else can you really say about it? It's not the kind of thing that you can discuss formally or thematically, really. It just was kind of there.
I know. I mean, it does have a plot. So the plot is, it's a group of older women who form a cheerleading squad at a retirement community, right? It is a retirement community.
Yeah.
Just for the fun of it, I guess, and to prove that they can still do it. So it is a premise that could have led to a fun movie. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, the writing here was so bad and the performances, except for Jackie Weaver, were non-existent, and the editing was terrible, and I don't think it had a director, so in the end, you just end up with an hour and a half of basically nothing.
Well, Diane Keaton smiling a lot, and she is as charming as ever, though strangely, her character is rather ornery for the first 15, 20 minutes of the movie, which is not that typical for her. Usually, she plays more, you know, charm machines, and here she was kind of a grump. It began as a grumpy old women type of movie.
Yeah.
It didn't stay that way, but.
Yes. I mean, I think the most egregious thing about this movie is that it's a group of eight women, so led by Diane Keaton and her friend, Jackie Weaver. But we know nothing about the other six women. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't get any characterizations at all. They don't get any scene, story, nothing. They're just background players. Like, literally, one of them's whole thing is that she comes out and says, "I have a nice smile." And that's it. That's all we know about her.
And Pam Grier is in it. And third build. And so, Murtada, you have to share your reaction to Pam Grier's first big scene.
So, Pam Grier is one of the other six women who, like we said, don't get anything to do. And the first, I think it was the first time she ever speaks, is like way into the movie after the cheerleading squad has been disbanded because there is a villain, whatever. It doesn't matter. But it's already, we're well into the movie, and I think this is the first time she ever says anything, and she looks at her husband in the movie, and she's like, "I miss the girls from the squad." And I'm like, what? We never even saw you bond with them or be their friend or even talk to any of them. And now we are supposed to believe you miss them?
Yeah, it was a big waste of Pam Grier. But at least her fame got her third billing.
Yes.
So I hope she was paid well.
Let's hope so, because it's the only reason for these. You know, and these actresses are all amazing, and we have seen them do, like, Phyllis Somerville is one of the eight. Mm-hmm. Pam Grier we talked about. Celia Weston is wasted as the villain. Like, these are all amazing actresses, and they should get, you know, a much better written movie than this. Like, I mean, the last time we talked about Gloria and Diane and what those movies gave to older actresses. Like, everybody here deserves something like that instead of Palms. I mean, Angelica Houston was right.
Yeah, so for those of you who weren't following on along, Angelica Houston in the interview with Vulture, I think it was?
Yes.
Got pretty bitchy about Diane Keaton's career and doing a cheerleader movie.
Yeah. I mean, she was bitchy specifically about this movie. I guess maybe she was offered Jackie Weaver's part or something.
Yeah. Jackie Weaver seems to be the only actor involved who is really, really going to sell it if it kills her.
Yeah. I mean, she is the one who's like, I'm going to be good no matter what this is. I have a character. I'm going to make up something. I'm going to give every scene I'm in verve and panache, and I'm going to give it to my fans, you know. So thank you, Jackie, because if it wasn't for you, this movie would have been, like, completely unbearable.
I liked it slightly more than Murtaza did. All I was hoping going in was that it was as good as Book Club, and I am sad to report that it was not.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit of what you liked. I'm sorry, I ranted a lot. So tell us a little bit about what you liked.
Well, there's this subplot kind of about like a bitchy high school girl who has a turnaround and becomes sympathetic and helps the older women because she feels bad about her involvement in it's a long story. Way too long for the podcast, but this movie's plot has lots of weird little things that make no sense.
Yeah,
but anyway, she ends up the main high school girl that's in the movie ends up having this change of heart and helps them, and I enjoyed how sweet that subplot was. Like, you think one way about her, and then she turns out to be, like, a good person at heart. And it was very corny, but I enjoyed that subplot.
Yeah, and I agree with you. Like, that the way that her character was sort of, I guess, written, although I hardly think anybody wrote anything with this. But anyway, it was surprising. Mm-hmm. And it took you places where you just, like, to your point, you expected her to just be the bitchy high schooler, but she was much more, or a little bit more than that.
Yeah. And there was, spoiler alert, there's a scene early in the movie where Diane Keaton is watching TV and she sees this this commercial for being cremated and having your ashes scattered within fireworks. Like, during a fireworks display, you could have your ashes explode over your town or whatever. And yeah. I thought it was like a comedy bit, because I was like, oh wow, we're really going broad with the like satire about retirement communities, right? But it turns out it was actually intended as like
Chekhov's gun.
Yeah. Yeah, it was intended to have sort of a gravitas, and I was like, oh, I misread that scene. I thought we were doing like camp satire about a retirement community where people are constantly dying.
Yeah, I mean, it's like that. That's a lot of the movie is like that. Like, it's played straight when you don't think it's played straight, and then something is played funny when you're like, huh? And like the jokes fall flat, and like it's just like, I think also there is the editing is very haphazard. It's like they shot a lot, and then I don't know, they didn't know where to put it. So sometimes things happen after other things have already happened, and you're like, this should have, like, happened 20 minutes ago.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that. It's a little Mamma Mia-esque in its sort of randomness in terms of shot choices and editing. It's kind of all over the place. But there also is a nearly wordless performance that I thought was really good. I loved the security guard in training, this old woman, Doris.
Yes.
I thought she was very funny every time the camera checked in on her, although she also made no sense. It was like, for some reason, she was like a traitor to her, you know.
Yes,
her boss.
Yeah, for no reason.
Yeah.
But the actress had such a great face. Like, whenever they cut to her, it's like it was immediately funny.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was very easy to sit through, but it was not good. I am sad to report.
Yes. I wish it upon no one, so skip it, please.
it wasn't that bad. If it's on, you know, once it's streaming or whatever and you feel like you need your Diane Keaton kick, you know, go ahead.
Yeah, at home where you have a lot of distractions that can take you through the bad moments instead of having to pay attention for the full 91 minutes, then yes, you can watch it then.
But mercifully, it is only 90 minutes, which the same cannot be said of our other movie that we saw this week, Under the Silver Lake.
Yes.
Which is 2 hours and...
20 minutes, something like
25, that. 25, something like that. Long.
Yeah.
Especially for a movie filled with red herrings. This
yes.
is one of those noirs where you, like, you're paying attention to everything because it seems like everything is important, and then you realize that maybe none of it is important.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, like, sort of chasing your own tail business that goes on in the movie.
Yeah. I mean, the plot is, if we want to, you know, set it up, you know, it's Andrew Garfield is this L.A. drifter who is unemployed, does nothing. And then he falls for his mysterious neighbor, played by Riley Keough. And they share one night of sort of aborted flirting. And they make tentative plans to meet the next day. And then when he knocks on her door, she has disappeared, sold of all her furniture, and sort of he spends the rest of the movie trying to find her. Mm-hmm. And then he uncovers all this, I guess it's a conspiracy, mythology. It's all to do with L.A., and it's underground, and then there is, it's very strange. You know, like, you don't need to know what happens, because I don't, to Nathaniel's point, I don't think it matters.
Yeah, and he spends the whole movie in sort of a state of being stoned.
Yes.
I mean, it's not always directly, you don't like see him smoking weed all the time or whatever, but mm-hmm. there's definitely a sense that he's always like a little out of it.
Yes. I particularly loved when he imagines people barking at him. So there is a yes. very stylish scene where Riley Keough comes out of a swimming pool and then barks at the camera.
Yeah. So, which I am sure Riley Keough enjoyed doing.
Yes. So anyway, like, it is very stylish. It looks great, I think. So
yeah.
It has a lot to offer, even if it is way too long.
Yeah.
Did it remind you? I thought of, sometimes it reminded me of David Lynch. Sometimes I was like, this is like Inherent Vice from Paul Thomas Anderson. He's definitely paying homage to other L.A. movies and
stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it felt a little to me like, you know, we should backtrack a little bit. David Robert Mitchell, who directed this, is the guy behind It Follows, which was his big breakout, a very stylishly directed, great horror movie. But that one had, like, it felt like it had propulsive momentum,
mm-hmm.
and it was going somewhere, and it was very focused, I thought. Given that it could have been all over the place. And this is just, this is kind of all over the place. It kind of feels a little bit like a Julie Taymor movie in that way. Like, whatever occurred to him, he's going to put it in the movie.
Yes, you know, exactly.
Whatever visual influence he likes, whatever, you know, like, trope he likes, what, you know, and, like, to your point with, like, the Lynchian stuff and, you know, the hodgepodge of characters in sort of the sub genre of Los Angeles noir.
Mm-hmm.
It was like opening a treasure chest of things that he probably loves.
Yeah. I also find it exhausting because there is a mystery at the center of it. Like we said, he's trying to find his neighbor,
mm-hmm.
this woman he sort of kind of, I wouldn't call it love because basically they met for like 10 minutes. But anyway, he's
infatuated. That's enough in movies, you know. That's enough in movies. Think of how many marriage proposals in 40s movies happen after 10 minutes.
Yeah. Okay, he loves her. He's infatuated with her. But anyway, I knew we were going to talk about this movie, so I was trying to follow the plot, basically trying to figure out all the signs and all the people he meets who give him clues that are supposedly going to solve the mystery. So just following all of this and trying to keep it all, like, in my head, I just was exhausted by the end. Like, I was like, literally, I turned it off and jumped into bed. I was like, oh, sleep, please.
Yeah, I can't say that it was satisfying, but it was definitely... It was definitely, it seems weird to say this, but it was definitely well made, even though I don't think it was good.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's obviously a director with vision. I just...
Oh, yeah.
I just wish that maybe he had someone to not let him indulge every idea he had.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many images that, you know, you just are so great to look at, like... There's, he goes to this party, and it's a very L.A. party. Like, even the snippets of conversation in that party are amazing. And you're like, oh, yeah, L.A. And then, you know, one of the minor character comes out, and she is wearing a dress of balloons, and she does this dance. And, like, these are sort of very beautiful images and also, like, things that you haven't seen in other movies. So he is definitely somebody with, like, to your point, with great vision.
Mm-hmm.
And he puts lots of it. It's a very stylish movie. Like, every frame, it's, like, very stylish, from the color of Andrew Garfield's T-shirts to the background. The colors just jump at you.
Yeah, like, there's even animation segments that actually work well with the movie, which... Even though they also feel like an indulgence. And he uses his skills with horror in one of the subplots involving, mm-hmm. like, an owl woman. I don't want to spoil it, but that stuff was really scary, I thought.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it felt like several movies all at the same time without a lot of discipline.
Yes. Do we want to say anything about Andrew Garfield's performance?
I'm not sure I have anything to say about it. I've gone back and forth on him as an actor. You know, when he first appeared, like everyone else, I thought he was great. And then a few more movies in, I was wondering about his limitations as an actor. I can't say that I really dug him in this role, because I didn't... It feels like a vessel role for whatever the director wants to throw at you plot-wise, but it doesn't feel like a character to me.
Yeah, he's the character is very vague. But I did find him watchable, which I thought he carried it off well. Like, I was never sort of, I don't want to say bored, because... But I found him watchable is kind of what I want to say about him. Like, he had done this sort of vessel character before, like, for instance, in Silence with Scorsese. And there I just didn't find him that compelling. I think he's a little bit more compelling here and more relaxed.
Oh, I agree. Yeah. With that comparison, totally agree. Yeah. Because even though he is not a Californian actor, he really, like, melds well in that atmosphere.
Yeah.
He feels believable as, like, a sort of, you know, aimless guy, like, killing time in L.A.
Yes, for sure. He doesn't treat his female characters very well, I think. They were all sort of abstractions, I guess, of, like, they felt like abstraction of the Garfield character's imagination. Because we talked a little bit about how he's, like, constantly stoned, or you never know if this is imagination or it's really happening to him. So every other character feels like that too. So, and there are a lot of, like, minor female characters, and they're all sometimes naked or half naked. And
yeah, it's definitely a male gaze movie. And that's G-A-Z-E, not G-A-Y-S.
Yeah.
Other than shots of Andrew Garfield's ass, it's not very gay. But there's a lot of male gaze. Yeah, a lot of naked women. A lot of sexy, mysterious women.
And I'm not sure that there was enough sort of, like, subverting of those images or of those characters. It was just, like, presented as, like, oh, there you go, as opposed to saying, you know, commenting on the male gaze. It was just a male gaze movie with no sort of comment on that at all.
Well, I did, on that note, I did sort of enjoy how ballsy the movie was in terms of what it was willing to include. Like, there's this very random scene where Andrew Garfield's character, I forget his name because he's such a vague character.
Sam, I think.
Yeah, so he sees, like, these young little boys, like, vandalizing his car and other cars in the neighborhood, and he goes and beats the shit out of this little boy, and it just shows it, and I'm like, oh, yes. And he's the lead character, the one you're supposed to be, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, those little boys were awful, but I don't think I've seen the hero, in quotes, of a movie beat up a little kid before in a movie.
No. Well, he's definitely, like an anti-hero, yeah. And also, does he rant about the homeless? Did I imagine that?
Oh, yes. No, he does. There's also some very non-PC stuff about how awful homeless people are. So I didn't know ever, because of the style of the movie, how serious David Robert Mitchell wanted us to take this.
Mm-hmm.
So in that regard, I don't know if it was just, like, character choices or if he's, like, telling you all his ideas and, you know, depiction or endorsement, who knows?
Yes. And I guess that could be his point, who knows? But anyway, I mean, I would say this movie is, like, I wouldn't say it's worth 2.5 hours, but it's definitely worth checking out.
It's one of those movies that probably plays really, really great in clip form.
Yes.
Like, if you just see a scene, you might think, oh, this movie is awesome. And then you would find that it's maybe not. Awesome might not be the word.
Yeah. But it's not a waste of time, because, like, you know, there are things in it that you will not find in any other movie. So check it out.
Yeah, like beating up little kids as, like, a moment you're supposed to root for.
I was thinking of, you know, more people barking as dogs.
Well, that too, yeah. Or a naked woman holding her nose while she talks to her boyfriend because he's been sprayed by a skunk. There's lots of weird stuff in this movie.
Yes. So if you've seen it, let us know in the comments what you thought of Under the Silver Lake. Because I think it's a divisive movie and some people love it. Some people are like us, sort of like some of it, and there is also outright hate for it. I mean, it was at Cannes in competition last year, and people did not care for it to the extent that it was released almost a year after that premiere.
And it has made only $46,000. Like, A24 totally dumped it. I didn't even realize it had come out. That's how under the radar it was.
Yeah.
And a friend called me and, like, I'm seeing this movie tonight. Do you want to go? And I'm like, okay. And I didn't realize it had been out for a month already.
Yeah. I think more than a month now. So it's only playing. I mean, it's in New York. It's only playing in one cinema. So.
Yeah. I do think it's one of these movies that will be reevaluated, not because it deserves to be, but because I do think he's going to have an interesting career. So people will probably go back to it at some point.
Yeah, and watch it again once he, like, makes one that everybody raves about. Yeah.
And it might be one, if he does prove to have a long career, it might be one of those movies where you see, oh, that was his experiment movie that didn't work, but look at what it gave him in these other ways. Like, you know.
Yeah, I can see that for sure, yeah.
Yeah, but it's kind of a mess. It's definitely not It Follows, which
no.
I have nothing but good things to say about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not even a genre I like very much.
Yes. But it's very stylish, so if you're into style, go see it.
Yes.
Did you get to see The Hustle?
I did, yeah, so you can ask me questions about it.
So why don't you tell us, what is The Hustle about?
I think everybody knows what The Hustle is about. It's a remake of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, and gender flipped, like a couple remakes have been recently.
Which also was a remake, so it's this yes. is the third iteration, right?
Yeah. So if you've seen that 80s film, the 1988 film, Steve Martin and Michael Caine were the stars. So basically Rebel Wilson has the Steve Martin part and Anne Hathaway has the refined con artist part, which was played by Michael Caine.
So did you laugh more at The Hustle or at Palms?
Oh, at The Hustle.
Oh, okay. So I guess I chose the wrong movie to go with you.
I mean, The Hustle, here's the thing. Apparently it was completely savaged by critics.
Uh-huh.
I have no idea why. I mean, it's not going to make my top 10 list or anything. I can't say, oh, rush out to see this, but it was, you know, a fun, pleasant diversion at the movies.
Yeah. I mean, the New York Times gave it sort of exactly that review. They're like, but you know, it's fine.
Yeah. I was laughing hard at a few moments. Rebel Wilson, even though I realize, you know, a lot of people don't like her because it's very shticky, her humor, and very sort of all the same. I thought she was really funny in it. Anne Hathaway was more of a mixed bag, which surprised me because, you know, I'm a huge Hathaway nut.
Mm-hmm. Why? Tell me, why was she a mixed bag?
Well, she's playing a, you know, this refined con artist, so she's always doing an accent. And the accent itself, it reminded me a little bit of Amy Adams in American Hustle, in that I was like, are you purposely doing a bad accent because you're a con artist, or are you just doing a bad accent?
Okay.
And could decide if it was meant to be slightly bad or if it just actually was bad.
Well, she's not great with English accents, as we've seen from Becoming Jane.
Yeah. Isn't she British in One Day, too?
Yes, also not a great accent.
Yeah. Yeah, but this is more like a vague, you know, fancy person accent. Slightly British. I don't know. It's kind of bad, but she's more fun, like, when she starts doing characters within that character, you know, they're con artists.
Is she the straight man, basically, or the straight woman to Rebel Wilson? Or does she get to be funny, too?
Oh, she gets to be funny, too. But Rebel Wilson is doing the very sort of broad, slapsticky stuff.
And who plays sort of the Glenn Headley part?
It's Alex Sharp from the Tony winner, what did he win for? The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime or something like that.
Yes, you got it. That's it.
And he was in, How to Talk. That Cameron Mitchell movie.
How to Talk to Girls at Parties.
Yes, How to Talk to Girls at Parties. He was the lead in that. So he's a young, promising actor, and I thought he was really good in this. But yeah, it's very disposable, but it was fun. Like, I laughed quite a bit.
Oh, well, that's good.
And I will say this because it's so rare that I get to say this. Loved the opening credit sequence. It had a totally, like, one of those credit sequences that's apart from the movie. It's like its own little bit, animated. It was great.
Wow.
Too few movies do credit sequences these days.
So what didn't work about it besides Anne Hathaway's, you know, inconsistency?
It just was a little uninspired, you know, like if you've seen Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, you've seen this. I thought it was going to be a looser, you know, remake, just because they were gender flipping, and I'm like, oh, it'll be, you know, they'll change a bunch of stuff, but it was really basically that movie again.
Oh, wow.
And since I liked that movie and saw it a few times in the 80s, like, I remember that movie well, so I was like, oh, yeah, it's the same movie again. So in that way, it felt very, you know, I didn't need to see it. I was hoping for a little more, yeah, invention.
Yeah. Well, so if you want to see The Hustle, you better hustle, because it's not making any money, so it's probably not going to stay in theaters long.
Although it was crowded when I went last night, so, I mean, it's only the second weekend.
Yeah.
And there must have been, it was either somebody's birthday party or a school trip, although I don't know why a school trip would be late at night on the weekend, but there was a ton of kids in my theater. Like, and they were really enjoying it, so.
That's definitely more than Who Sold Palms with us, because I think there were five of us in that theater for Palms.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely felt like somebody's, you know, birthday party or something. There was a lot of, like, young teenagers, like, that type of birthday party. Like, 12-year-olds or something, 13-year-olds.
Yes.
I was like, why are they at this movie? But then maybe it's Rebel Wilson. I don't know. They thought she was very funny.
I mean, Rebel Wilson always has one joke, so I'm assuming she has a few more in this one.
I mean, it's kind of the same joke as in her other movies.
But you liked it more in this one, or you just...
No, I always enjoy her. I get why people don't. It's very, very shticky. But I think she's funny. She's naturally funny. I do think she could use, like, a director who wanted to push her and see if he could get something else from her, comedy-wise.
Well, she's in the Taika Waititi Hitler movie, so we'll see.
Oh, well, yeah. Well, that's like, he's, like, a real director, so he might get something out of her.
Yeah.
Because I think if you have that kind of innate comic sensibility that you don't really need the writing to be good or the movie to be good, and you're just going to be always the same degree of funny, mm-hmm. then you, if you had a really great director, you could elevate it. That's my theory.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so it has been kind of an uninspiring summer at the movies.
Yes. But maybe next week will change with Booksmart. I'm looking forward to that.
Yes. I will say this, the trailers that we saw during before The Hustle were uniformly other than Stupor, I guess it's called. I don't think I would see that one, but everything else, I was like, oh, I would see this. So I think the late summer is going to be better than the early summer.
So what are some of the ones that you like, the trailers?
Oh, they've already left my mind.
Very memorable.
No, but what I'm saying is while you're watching it, like, well, Booksmart was one. Where'd You Go, Bernadette?
That's not till August. But Booksmart is next week. Did you see Ma? I'm looking forward to that.
I've seen that trailer a million times, but they didn't show it last night.
Oh, okay. I mean, you know, I'm looking at June, so maybe it will brighten up Booksmart, Maw.
Yeah, because we didn't intend to be absent these past 2 weeks from the podcast, but there was like nothing, like what, yes. You know, there was nothing to discuss.
Yes.
Which
I've seen some other movies. I don't know if you want to.
Oh, yes. Let's talk about that.
I've seen The Souvenir, which I've seen at Sundance, and it is sort of like the indie movie of this weekend. It had the highest per screen average, and it is a Joanna Hogg movie, who is a British avant-garde producer, photographer and director, and this is sort of, I think, to me at least, I think this is her first movie that is released in the States, because I never remember seeing her other movies in release. Anyway.
I know she made a couple with Tom Hiddleston, but I don't know if they got released.
Yeah, so this is a story. It's basically based on her life as a film student in London in the 80s, and she is played, or the character is played by Honor Byrne Swinton, or Honor Swinton Byrne, who is Tilda Swinton's daughter. And Tilda herself is in the movie as that the main character's mother. And it's a story sort of a codependent relationship between this film student and a slightly older man, probably in his early 30s, who she meets and starts a love affair with. And the story is one of those stories where, like, I can see why people love this movie so much. I didn't love it as much, but it's one of those stories where it doesn't tell you at all what is happening, which is, so it's only through, like, at least half the movie is over before you realize what this story is about. I mean, I don't want to spoil it. I have a review on the side that actually spoils what it's about. So if you want to know, read the review. But I just thought it went on a little too long. And I was just, like, over it. It kept repeating the same things. But it looks amazing. And it withholds the narrative in a way that, really smart, and for a while it really held my interest, and I kept saying, oh wow, this movie's great, but it just did too much of the same for me. And the lead performance is very sort of restrained. I know people have been talking about her as like a star turn, but I thought it was the antithesis of a star turn, because she's good, but she's very restrained. And it is actually the actor playing the lead, the guy she falls in love with, his name is, I think, Tom Burke, who gets the more flamboyant performance. He gets to do more, and mm-hmm. he is also great. I thought he was really, really good, and he gives a great performance. So this could be a movie that Harold is, you know, these two actors' career. So maybe in the same way as Mitchell and Under the Silver Lake, if they get the careers, especially him, if they get those careers, we will look back and say, oh, this was the first time we saw them. But I don't know that there is a big audience for this movie. It's still very much.
Yeah, I mean, the people who love it really love it. I think Guy Lodge said it was his favorite this year so far. Yeah, people either seem to be like you, where they're respectful but don't love it. And, you know, the people who don't love it think it's too slow and repetitive.
Yeah, I mean, it's so funny to me that people love it so much at Sundance, because I saw it at Sundance. I was sitting next to Manuel Betancourt. You guys know him. He used to write for the site. And basically, we had the same reaction to this movie. And then you go around, and I've heard that reaction from everybody I met about it. But then suddenly the reviews come out, and it's like, it's the best film at Sundance. And I'm like, where were you people? You were not at the same screening.
It's so like one of those festival things where once people get to their laptop, you know, and start writing. I mean, writing about a movie does sometimes shift what you thought of it.
Yes. Yeah, and it maybe is a movie that it definitely needs to, like, simmer and settle. Mm-hmm. But to me, it simmered and settled on my gut reaction, which is what I just told you about.
Mm-hmm. How's Tilda?
Tiny, tiny part.
So they basically put all of her scenes in the trailer, because she's all over the trailer.
I think so. I mean, yeah. I haven't seen the trailer, but the scene that I really, really love is all about Tilda, which is, like, Tilda plays sort of like, you know, a very rich and privileged woman. She's the mom of this character, and they are having a dinner party at her house, at Tilda's character's house. And the conversation in that, which they're liberal, but very privileged, and sort of they're trying to talk about, you know, social things, and like the tenor of the conversation and sort of the opinions that they share. I thought that was like one of the more astute, sort of biting, funny, sort of depictions in class that you ever mm-hmm. see in movies. And she's very good at that. Like throughout the film, Joanne Hogg does that very well. also is this sort of like spare writing and just sort of like the way she films Tilda's house and, you know, her country house and the way they dress, you know, and talk with each other. It's like, you're like, oh, very good. Especially when you sort of like just oppose that with the character's friends from film school and how they talk. And it's like, very funny. So I think she's very astute in the way she depicts class, and that's one of the things that are best about this film.
Yes, I should see this. If you have seen it, I would love to hear other reactions. Well, convince me that I have missed out on something great in my comments, if you will. And have you seen anything else recently?
Well, I've seen Nonfiction, which is the SIS film, which is sort of funny. Like, I enjoyed it. I saw it at the New York Film Festival, and like sometimes when you see a movie at Walter Reed and you're just like in it and you think it's the best thing ever. So I really, really enjoyed when I saw it, and there is a fantastic performance in it, and it's not Juliette Binoche. Mm-hmm. It's Nora Hamzawi, who has a supporting part in it. She's so funny.
You listed her on one of your five favorite performances from that festival.
Yeah, the movie is basically about, you know, it's about this group of characters. They're all sleeping with each other. There's a lot of adultery. But they all work in publishing, or most of them work in publishing. And it's sort of about technology versus like, you know, online versus analog. Do people buy books? Do people just read online? That's the main thrust. But it's basically a series of conversations between six or seven characters. It's just they're at dinner parties, they're at cafes, they're like in hotel rooms fucking each other. But, you know, you only see the conversation before and after. So it's a series of conversation. Mm-hmm. And Nora Hamzawi is so funny. Like, every conversation she's not part of, you're just like, where is she? Why is she not in this scene? And she is like, kind of loves her husband, but also hates his guts. And she sort of admires Juliette Binoche, but also thinks she's terrible. And, like, she always has these contrasting opinions about all the other characters. And so she's just so funny playing it. Mm-hmm. I think it's, I would give her my best supporting actress of the year right now.
Wow. endorsement, for people of our persuasion, actresexuals.
Yes.
I saw another one, The White Crow.
The Ray Fiennes,
yes.
Is it Nureyev biopic?
Yeah, the Nureyev biopic. And for those of you who haven't heard of this, it's, you know, of course, the famous ballet dancer, Rudolf Nureyev, and it's about his youth before he came to the States. So, like, you know, the way he escaped Russia, basically, and all that. So it's about his training as a dancer. He started late in his training. And he found this mentor, which is played by Ralph Fiennes. So Ralph Fiennes speaks Russian all throughout the movie. I don't speak Russian, so I couldn't say how well he speaks it, but he seems to fit right in with the Russian actors. And they cast real dancers as the dancers, so the guy playing Nureyev is an actual ballet dancer.
So there's a lot of good dance scenes.
Yeah, and Ralph thankfully shoots them like at a remove, so you can actually see the bodies, which I always appreciate with dance sequences in movies, because too many filmmakers are like, you need close-ups, and I'm like, I really don't. Dance is about bodies. But it's a little... Did you ever see that movie Invisible Woman that Rafe made?
Yes, the one with Felicity Jones. Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, about Charles Dickens's affairs and all that. So it's a little like that, and like in terms of it's very handsome and like the acting's very good, but it's just like .. Like there's some sort of energy missing in his films as a director, I think.
Yeah. I hear you, yeah.
I even felt that a little bit about Coriolanus. even though that one was more energetic because, of course, it has, like, action and violence and things. But there, it's just like something's a little staid about them, and I wanted him to juice it up a little.
Oh, okay. Like, and I read some grumblings online that it sort of presents him as straight, and there's not enough of him being gay. Is that true?
That's not exactly true. Although the sexuality is very sort of, there's one scene that's very explicitly about the fact that he's sleeping with another male ballet dancer. Not an explicit sex scene, but like explicitly, like it's discussed between him mm-hmm. and the male dancer, and they're naked in bed and stuff. So it's like there's like one scene like that, but then the rest of it, his sort of like object of affection is Adele Exarchopoulos from Who's the Warmest Color. Although even that relationship, which is the main romantic relationship in the movie, it's presented mm-hmm. in a very platonic way, and she even sort of denies that there's any romantic connection between them. So it's very sexless movie, I will say. Which,
okay,
given Nureyev's like life, seemed a little like that would have been an obvious area to juice up the movie a little.
Yeah, he's a well-known gay.
Yeah. So I, you know, it's like a respectful, handsome, like art house film for older people. you know the type. You know.
Yes.
But I just wish it was better. I know. I'm sorry. I just wish it was better because, like, I realize these movies already have limited audiences. But I wanted to love it.
Yeah.
Because I love Ralph Fiennes. Like, I always want the best for him, but.
But maybe not as a director. I like him as an actor too, but I wouldn't say I do as a director.
Yeah. I did think some of the relationships were interesting. Like, one of the main relationships in the movie is between, there's sort of a triangular relationship between Ralph Fiennes as the mentor, Ralph Fiennes' wife, and Nureyev, who actually comes to live with them at one point. And so it's like this strangely like sexual but not sexual like triangular relationship. So I thought that was interesting, but again, it was like some like why is Fiennes so restrained as a director? Because like sometimes restraint's not the answer.
Yeah, especially in a story about an artist. Like I'm sure Nureyev was. You know, I had outsized thing to be such a successful artist. You probably had volcanic emotions.
Yeah. And he has those here, but they always in sort of ways that could be interpreted not as art, but as like tantrums, like entitlement,
yeah,
as opposed to artistic temperament, if that makes sense.
I hear you. Yep.
So I wish I could give this a ringing endorsement, but unfortunately I cannot.
Yeah. So we did talk about several movies. Mm-hmm. So let us know if you've seen any of these movies, what you thought of them, and we will reconvene next week with Booksmart.
With Booksmart and, I did want to say, I think I've mentioned it on the podcast before, but if I haven't, Shadow, the new Zhang Yimou. You should go see that. And obviously it sounds like you should go see The Souvenir too, and I will as well this week.
Yes.
So at your local art house movie theater, see Shadow and Souvenir.
Thank you so much for listening, and talk to you soon.